You said you come from where?
I'm from the UK originally, from England. Yeah.
Okay. Where in England?
I was born 20 miles from the Scottish border in the Northumberland, and then went to college in the southwest in Devon, and then lived for 5 years in Oxford before coming over here in 1983. We came over. And I began quilting as a hobby, and then it has become much more than that. So I'm teaching, traveling and teaching, and I have been doing this for about 20 years now. So I love sharing my passion with other people, and really enjoy both traveling and teaching. So actually, I began quilting when we moved to Arkansas. And we went to Fayetteville, Arkansas in 1986. And we'd go out in the Ozarks and see quilts hanging on picket fences and clotheslines, and they were for sale. And I couldn't afford to buy one, so I thought, well, I could make one of those. Got a book out of the library, and ended up using a rather antiquated technique of drawing around cardboard templates and hand piecing all these 8-pointed stars for my first quilt. Then found the local quilt group, who kind of took me in and mothered me, and they got me doing a beginner's quilting class. And so I discovered the fast piecing techniques and the rotary cutter, which make a quilter's job much easier. And the shortcut techniques. And I just became hooked, because I really love working with the geometric shapes and all the different colors. And quilting is a productive hobby, but it's also amazes me the number of variations you can get on even the simplest of patterns, just by how you place your fabrics and the lights and the darks. And everybody's quilting is original and unique. And one of the things I love as a teacher is seeing all the different fabrics that my students bring to class, and seeing all the different results from what I teach. That's really fun. And the students learn from each other also, seeing that.
So you essentially taught yourself in the beginning.
Well, I started on my own, and then I took a beginner quilting class, just half a day a week for 6 weeks. So that kind of got me going. And then we actually moved to Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was active in the Arkansas Quilters Guild, and there were some really talented women in that group, and I really loved their work, so they inspired me. And some of them were kind of way ahead of their time. There was one lady hand dyeing fabrics, and she was doing color gradations of triangles, which in the early 90s, like, nobody was doing that. Another lady was doing these, starting with traditional blocks and changing them to make them more contemporary looking. And so they really inspired me. And while I love the traditional patterns, I like to do my own twist on those. And my work has been coming up with some new techniques that to use that are easy to do, but the results can look complicated. And for my students, I like to open up the opportunity for them to actually design their own quilts. And many quilters are intimidated about doing that, and they're intimidated about choosing fabrics. And so I try to make it easier for them to do that. And one of the workshops I teach, I designed a new quilt block, and which is very easy to piece. And then when you have the blocks, you can rotate them and make all these different patterns. So it's very easy for the students to make the blocks and then to start playing, and they're creating their own designs. So it's not such an intimidating thing to be designing your own piece when all you have to do is rotate the blocks and you get different patterns. And so you can find something that's pleasing. So I really, really like to open the door for quilters to do that and use their own imagination. It's a lot of fun.
You mentioned traditional patterns. What is the traditional quilt pattern?
Kind of time-tested traditional quilt blocks, for example, a log cabin. There are many different quilt blocks that have been around for a long time, and the you know, the traditional American quilts are made from quilt blocks because the pioneers who came over just had scraps to work with. And so they would make all these quilt blocks. And many of the names are inspired by things that were around them, like the windmill or the hole in the wall or the rocky road to California. And then there's the log cabin is, of course, a classic because it has the logs, and it's the center of the log cabin was traditionally red for the heart or the fire in the hearth, you know, the warmth in the house, or else it was yellow for the lantern in the window of the log cabin. And so there are all kinds of stories that go along with these traditional quilt blocks as well. And during the slaves who managed to get north, there was a whole underground railroad system where they would hang out quilts, and the quilts actually sent messages to the people who were trying to flee. So it would say, you know, this is a safe place, or don't come here, depending on the quilt pattern that was hanging out outside the farmhouse. So the quilting tradition goes back a long way, and it's very interesting. And there's several quilt blocks that have a variety of names, you know, depending on where you are in the country or exactly how the variation on the particular block. So the log cabin has a setting that's called Courthouse Steps, and so there are many examples like that. And a pineapple block is essentially a log cabin block, but just done in a different way. So it's fun exploring all the different options. And there are, you know, many very simple blocks, just like a nine patch, which is basically nine squares. But even with these very simple designs, all the quilts look different because of how you place the lights and the darks and the fabrics that you choose. So everybody's work is original and unique.
Looking back to the history of the quilts, would they have been hung up on the walls like tapestries to keep the warmth in, or were they mostly used for beds?
Mostly for beds, yeah. So the pioneers were making utilizing scraps and making quilts to keep them warm. So traditionally, quilts were bed quilts. In the Victorian era, they did use them decoratively, and they used leftover pieces from dresses, so like velvet and silk. And they used the scraps left over from the dressmaking, so they were sort of crazy patchwork, so they're irregular shaped pieces. And then they did really ornate embroidery all over them. And so those pieces were often not true quilts because they didn't have batting in them. They would have a backing, and then they would have them in the parlor, and they would be draped over the couch or maybe over the end of the bed, so they would be more decorative pieces instead of quilts to keep people warm.
And so that's what characterizes a real quilt, is the batting, you said?
Well, a quilt has three layers, so it has a backing, a batting, and a quilt top, and the quilting stitches hold the three layers together. So that is a true quilt, which, of course, differs from a blanket, which is just one layer. So some of the quilts are tied. Some of the older quilts that were really utilitarian, they just put ties instead of actually having quilting stitches going through. But you need to have something that holds those three layers together. Otherwise, the batting will all ball up inside. So some of the quilting patterns are really elaborate, as well as having the piece geometric shapes or applique. The traditional Baltimore album quilts are very detailed applique cornucopias and baskets of flowers and all kinds of things like that. And so they're very small, tiny applique pieces, but then the quilting stitches still have to hold the three layers together. And some of those quilting patterns are very elaborate. And the European quilts originally were what's called whole cloth quilts, which is where you just have one piece. And the whole quilt is the quilting design, the actual pattern of the stitching, which traditionally was done by hand. now is mostly done by machine. In fact, people have these long arm quilting machines, which are about 12 or 14 feet by 6 feet, and they have a free arm, so you can quilt really large quilts. There are several long arm quilters who have businesses and they quilt for other people. So there are many quilters like to just piece the quilt tops, and then the quilting part can be difficult. If you've got a large quilt and you're trying to use a regular sewing machine, just the bulk of having a big piece makes it challenging. So I quilt some of my quilts, but they're the smaller ones. And if I make a bed-sized quilt, then I go to a long-arm quilter who quilts my quilts for me. So Wanda Rains in Kingston, Washington, has been quilting my quilts for over 15 years. We've been working together. So any large piece, you know, she will do for me. If I'm just doing a crib quilt, I can do it on my home machine pretty easily. So you get to the bigger sizes, though, and it's definitely more challenging. So
you went from the wilds of Arkansas, essentially, where you book learned quilting to teaching quilting. So when did that happen? When did you go from being a learner to passing that along to other people?
Well, we moved to Little Rock, Arkansas, and I got involved with a project in my son's school. So I was working with kids in the school. And then also I joined this group called International Friends just to try to get to know some people in Little Rock. And it was about 80 internationals from all over the place. And then it was an outreach project actually of the Baptist Church. So they had Americans who were at that church were kind of hosting it. But they had all these different classes for people. And so they were looking to us, if any of us felt like we could teach a class. And so I started teaching quilting, beginning quilting. And I had mostly Japanese students. So that was kind of my first teaching adult. And it sort of grew from there. When we moved to Washington State, shortly after we got there, I did a big quilting project at my son's school. So we actually had a quilt auction as a PTO fundraiser, and every class in the school made a quilt. So by that time, I'd been quilting for 5 or 6 years, and I worked with a friend who was a quilter, and we headed up the project. And it was actually about a five-month project because every class in the school made a quilt, and there were 20 classes between kindergarten and fifth grade. So we worked with all the different teachers, and we tried to use topics that were in the curriculum. So, for example, my son's class was studying endangered species, so they did a quilt that was themed around endangered species, and each child studied a different animal, and then they drew a picture of that animal to go onto the quilt. So you can use all kinds of techniques for kids to do, have their artwork presented on a quilt, as well as teaching them some sewing as well. And if you go into schools, or do projects with groups of kids, it's amazing because you can bring in so many different subjects. So we had some fourth graders doing the history of Bainbridge Island. So they hand applique the island onto the background. So you've got your manual dexterity skills. They drew little landmarks, which they put on there. And then they studied the history and geography of the island, and they wrote historical facts on index card-sized pieces to go around the border of the quilt. And on the top and bottom, they were on the horizontal format, and on the sides, they were on the vertical format. And so the kids calculated the math of how many of these little panels they could fit on the sides and top and bottom of the quilts and the spacing in between. So you're bringing in all these different disciplines, and the kids don't even realize, you know, that they're doing the math because they're doing this cool quilting project, and they're doing math and geography and history and art, and it's all interdisciplinary. So you can really bring a lot of things in, and the kids love doing a special project like that.
It's very tricky, like hiding the vegetables beneath the potatoes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And how did you end up teaching in Mongolia?
Okay, so that was that came a bit later in 2003. I received an email from a Mongolian woman asking for help, and I could have easily click delete on that, but the topic was something like quilting in Mongolia, and I thought, that looks interesting. But it was a lengthy email from this young woman, Selengit Serendash, a Mongolian woman who wanted to help her fellow Mongolians, and she had a vision of creating a center where low-income and unemployed women could come to get together and socialize, but they could also make things so that they could sell stuff, which meant they would benefit both economically and socially. And this email went into great detail about how there was very high unemployment in the city, so there's kind of migration from the countryside to the city, and there's a whole shanty town of yurts on the outskirts of town, and without electricity and running water, and there's a high unemployment, a lot of alcoholism and abuse of the women, and the women were kind of left to hold the families together, but they didn't really have a support system for them. So she had this vision of creating a center where they could come, make friends, and also make things to sell. And quilting is actually a very good fit for Mongolian women, because even the nomadic families all have these hand-cranked Russian sewing machines, and they're very good seamstresses because it's just part of their way of life and part of their survival that they need to sew. And they have scraps that they can recycle, and they have basic sewing supplies like thread and scissors. So it's actually a very good fit for them. And Selengit Serendash is a very resourceful young lady, and she had found funding to rent a center from a Japanese organization that helps Asian women's groups. So she sent this email out to about 70 quilt teachers. So she found all our websites and contacted us. She received replies from about 20 people, and most of them were, sorry, I'm too busy, I can't help you with this. And a couple of them were, you know, what do you want me to teach? I need to stay in a hotel, da 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 da. And I just said, I'm interested in helping you, and kind of by default became the one who went. So in 2004, I took my 21-year-old daughter, Hazel, with me to Mongolia. The two of us went. And the quilting center just opened as we arrived, and Selenga had arranged for us to do presentations to groups of women, and she translated. And so we told them about the quilting center and told them a bit about quilting. Then in the afternoon, whoever showed up at the center, we would teach. And she had bags of shirting remnants, which she got from the clothing industry. And so we taught techniques to utilize those scraps. So we did strips for log cabins. We did crazy patchwork using odd shaped pieces. We did hexagons that are you fold over paper for English paper piecing. We made pot holders out of half square triangles. And then I taught them how to make tote bags with this Mongolian symbol, which is called the Oldzi, which is like a never-ending knot. And this symbol is all over the place in Mongolia. They paint it on the door of the yurts to bring long life and prosperity to the people who live there. And it drives away evil spirits and wild beasts. And then also in Tibetan Buddhism, which they practice in Mongolia, it's one of the eight special symbols, which means the universe. It's a never-ending knot. So it's continual cycles of life and death. So they started making these bags with the symbol on, and that was something that they were able to sell to other Mongolians and also to tourists. So that was really good. And a couple of women made all these bags, and when they had their big national holiday, they were able to sell them. And then they started putting the symbol on aprons. And I wanted to encourage them to produce something that was typically Mongolian rather than just reproducing American-style patchwork, so that the tourists who came would want to buy that. And also it might appeal to other Mongolians as well, especially this very significant symbol for them. So we were there in June, and the center just opened as we arrived. And unfortunately, 2 months later, there was a big earthquake in Japan. So the Japanese organization withdrew the funds that was funding the rent. So the center had to close because there was no money. And by Christmas, I had persuaded my church on Bainbridge Island, St. Barnabas Episcopal Church, to send over some money to Mongolia so that they could reopen the center. So we sent over $4,000. But the center that they opened was in the basement of an apartment block. So it was far from ideal. I mean, it was a place, but inadequate lighting, no heating. It's below freezing for 5 months of the year in Mongolia. It didn't have proper air circulation, and they would have some nasty floods from blocked toilets upstairs. So the women would clean up and persevere, but it really was far from ideal. So we knew we had to get them out of there and try to raise some money for to rent a different place. So 2 years later, in 2006, we went back to Mongolia and we had a quilt show in the department store. And it was amazing to see, I had just gone there to teach them basic beginning quilting. And these women had just taken what I taught them and were, they were then making aprons with this Aldzi symbol and they were making larger quilts with it on. I brought quilts from the States. Some quilters came from the UK and the Japanese ladies brought quilts from Japan. So it was an international quilt show. And it was very successful. We raised enough money for another year of rent. And then in 2007, the English quilters arranged for us to go to the Festival of Quilts in the UK, which is a huge show, very big show. And we had a special area for the Mongolian quilts. We were able to sell their products. They raised money so that Selenge could fly from Mongolia to the UK, and we all met there. And we raised enough money for another year of rent. And about the same time, I started a capital campaign, again hosted by my church, which is the non-profit host in the US. And over a period of 18 months, we raised $82,000 and we purchased a permanent facility for them. So they have a little shop and a classroom and an office and a tiny little bathroom. So they have a place, which is amazing. We went back in 2009 to see it and celebrate. And then in 2014, went again to do another quilt show. And other teachers have been as well, and they've had support from other groups as well. All kinds of organizations have given them grants and equipment. And so that both the US and the British embassies have helped them. And now they have contacted the Turkish embassy that's helping. German Development Agency, World Vision, Mercy Corps, several... Oh, International Women's Association in Mongolia. So various groups, will give them money to go out and teach in the countryside or go out to the shanty town of Yurts and teach out there. So, and the government also sponsor them to teach unemployed women quilting skills. So they've really had a whole variety of sources of funding, and they have become, a thriving organization, which, considering we started with nothing, now they have their own center. They have at least 5 part-time teachers. They have a manager, 3 seamstresses who put all the things together that they sell. And they have designers who design new products. and then at least 40 women who are doing piece work at home. So they're making sections of, they might make a decorative piece that's going to go on a bag, or different parts of the products, and then those go in to the seamstresses who put them together. So it's really had a huge ripple effect, and many women have benefited. And so many of these women who work at home are disabled, or for whatever reasons they can't get transportation into town and hold down a job, or they've got small children, or they might have disabled parents they're taking care of. So there's all kinds of situations where this is really helping them hugely, because they're making a little more money and they can, you know, survive. I encouraged them to use locally available materials, because we have sent over a lot of fabric, but they have beautiful silk available in Mongolia. So when they go to the temple, they wear these beautiful silk gowns with silk sashes, and there's a whole clothing industry that makes those. And Selenga discovered they were putting the scraps into the landfill, or they were burning them. So she was able to get great big bags of silk scraps in these beautiful, vibrant colors for free. And so they making quilt blocks out of them, and then they can go to the market and get bigger pieces to put borders around them, and they can make table runners and beautiful wall hangings. And so they've really, the silk has, they've done very well with that, because that's something that tourists just love, and it's different, and it's, you know, very Mongolian. So unfortunately, the clothing industry saw the nice things the women were making, and they started charging for the silk, but not very much. And then also in Mongolia, they have Kashmir, very good quality Kashmir. And the clothing industry also has scraps of Kashmir. So they've been making patchwork animals like camels and horses from scraps of Kashmir, and also scraps of silk. So those have done very well as well. Yeah.
Wow. That's such a great network that's been established because of that one email that you found.
Yeah, it's. I'm astonished when I think back of just my response to that. It was a very non-committal response, but, you know, it's developed into this relationship. And, you know, I've been a bit of a mentor to Selenga Serandash, and we stay in touch all the time. But the you know, this organization has survived because of her perseverance and tenacity. She's really an extraordinary person, and I applaud that. It's very unusual for somebody in the country to initiate something like this in a developing nation. It's usually another organization that goes in and organizes it all, you know.
Now you're here in Kodiak. And do you have any plans for Tuesday afternoon on?
I got here on Friday. So I came in on the ferry from Whittier. I did the 20-hour ferry trip.
Wow.
Yeah, and because I taught to the Kenai Peninsula quilters also.
Oh, cool.
So it's, and actually, the Kodiak group heard that I was teaching for Kenai, and so piggybacked onto that. So it's been quite a trip for me. I've just been thrilled to be here. It's been, I really enjoyed it, and seeing a different part of the world.
Well, and yeah, thank you so much for joining. That's all we've got time for right now, but thank you so much for coming by today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm delighted to be here.